Pressurized, he quickly doffed his suit. Having climbed the ladder to the crew compartment, he slid into the pilot's couch and booted the system. Grabbing the emergency launch checklist with one hand, he flicked switches rapidly with the other. One by one, the systems reported flight-ready status. As they came online, he noted one in particular. "Commander," he radioed, "the MAV's got a 7-degree tilt. It'll tip at 12.3. "Copy that," Lewis said. "Johansson," Beck said, looking at his arm computer. "Watney's biomonitor sent something before going offline. My computer just says bad packet."
"I have it too," Johansson said. "It didn't finish transmitting. Some data's missing and there's no checksum. Give me a sec."
"Commander," Martinez said, "message from Houston. We're officially scrubbed. The storm's definitely gonna be too rough."
"Copy," Lewis said.
"They sent that 4.5 minutes ago," Martinez continued, "while looking at satellite data from 9 minutes ago."
"Understood," Lewis said. "Continue prepping for launch."
"Copy," Martinez said.
"Beck," Johansson said, "I have the raw packet. It's plain text. BP 0, PR 0, TP 36.2. That's as far as it got."
"Copy," Beck said morosely. "Blood pressure 0, pulse rate 0, temperature normal."
The channel fell silent for some time. They continued pressing forward, shuffling through the sandstorm, hoping for a miracle.
"Temperature normal?" Lewis said, a hint of hope in her voice.
"It takes a while for the..." Beck stammered. "It takes a while to cool."
"Commander," Martinez said, "tilting at 10.5 degrees now with gusts pushing it to 11.
"Copy," Lewis said.
"Are you at pilot release?"
"Affirmative," Martinez replied.
"I can launch any time."
"If it tips, can you launch before it falls completely over?"
Martinez said, not expecting the question. "Yes, ma'am. I'd take manual control and go full throttle. Then I'd nose up and return to pre-programmed ascent."
"Copy that," Lewis said. "Everyone home in on Martinez's suit. That'll get you to the MAV airlock. Get in and prep for launch."
"What about you, Commander?" Beck asked.
"I'm searching a little more. Get moving. And Martinez, if you start to tip, launch."
"You really think I'll leave you behind?" Martinez said.
"I just ordered you to," Lewis replied. "You three, get to the ship."
They reluctantly obeyed Lewis's order and made their way toward the MAV. The punishing wind fought them every step of the way. Unable to see the ground, Lewis shuffled forward. Remembering something, she reached to her back and got a pair of rock drill bits. She had added the 1-meter bits to her equipment that morning, anticipating geological sampling later in the day. Holding one in each hand, she dragged them along the ground as she walked. After 20 meters, she turned around and walked the opposite direction. Walking a straight line proved to be impossible. Not only did she lack visual references, the endless wind pushed her off course. The sheer volume of attacking sand buried her feet with each step. Grunting, she pressed on. Beck, Johansson, and Vogel squeezed into the MAV airlock. Designed for two, it could be used by three in emergencies. As it equalized, Lewis's voice came over the radio.
"Johansson," she said, "would the rover IR camera do any good?"
"Negative," Johansson replied. "IR can't get through sand any better than visible light."
"What's she thinking?" Beck asked after removing his helmet. "She's a geologist. She knows IR can't get through a sandstorm."
"She's grasping," Vogel said, opening the inner door. "We must get to the couches. Please hurry."
"I don't feel good about this," Beck said.
"Neither do I, Doctor," said Vogel, climbing the ladder. "But the commander has given us orders. Insubordination will not help."
"Commander," Martinez radioed, "we're tilting 11.6 degrees. One good gust and we're tipping."
"What about the proximity radar?" Lewis said. "Could it detect Watney's suit?"
"No way," Martinez said. "It's made to see Hermes in orbit, not the metal in a single spacesuit."
"Give it a try," Lewis said.
"Commander," said Beck, putting on a headset as he slid into his acceleration couch. "I know you don't want to hear this, but Watney... Mark's dead."
"Copy," Lewis said. "Martinez, try the radar."
"Roger," Martinez radioed.
He brought the radar online and waited for it to complete a self-check. Glaring at Beck, he said,
"What's the matter with you?"
"My friend just died," Beck answered, "and I don't want my commander to die too."
Martinez gave him a stern look. Turning his attention back to the radar, he radioed,
"Negative contact on proximity radar."
Nothing?
Lewis asked.
I can barely see the hab, he replied. The sandstorm's fucking things up. Even if it wasn't, there's not enough metal in...
Shit! Strap in! He yelled to the crew. We're tipping!
The MAV creaked as it tilted faster and faster.
13 degrees,
Johansson called out from her couch.
Buckling his restraints, Vogel said,
We are far past balance. We will not rock back.
We can't leave her, Beck yelled. Let it tip. We'll fix it.
32 metric tons, including fuel,
Martinez said, his hands flying over the controls.
If it hits the ground, it'll do structural damage to the tanks, frame, and probably the second stage engine. We'd never be able to fix it.
You can't abandon her, Beck said.
You can't.
I've got one trick. If that doesn't work, I'm following her orders.
Bringing the orbital maneuvering system online, he fired a sustained burn from the nose cone array. The small thrusters fought against the lumbering mass of the slowly tilting spacecraft.
You're firing to OMS? Vogel asked.
I don't know if it'll work. We're not tipping very fast, Martinez said.
I think he's slowing down.
The aerodynamic caps will have automatically ejected, Vogel said. It will be a bumpy ascent with 3 holes in the side of the ship.
Thanks for the tip,
Martinez said, maintaining the burn and watching the tilt readout.
Come on.
Still 13 degrees, Johansson reported.
What's going on up there?
Lewis radioed. You went quiet. Respond.
Stand by, Martinez replied.
12.9 degrees, Johansson said.
It is working, Vogel said.
For now, Martinez said. I don't know if maneuvering fuel will last.
12.8 now, Johansson supplied.
OMS fuel at 60%, Beck said. How much do you need to dock with Hermes?
10%, if I don't fuck anything up, Martinez said, adjusting the thrust angle.
12.6, Johansson said. We're tipping back.
Or the wind died down a little, Beck postulated.
Fuel at 45%.
There is danger of damage to the vents, Vogel cautioned. The OMS was not made for prolonged thrusts.
I know, Martinez said. I can dock without nose vents if I have to.
Almost there, Johansson said.
Okay, we're under 12.3.
OMS cutoff, Martinez announced, terminating the burn.
Still tipping back, Johansson said.
11.6.
11.5.
Holding at 11.5.
OMS fuel at 22%, Beck said.
Yeah, I see that, Martinez replied.
It'll be enough.
Commander, Beck radioed, you need to get to the ship now.
Agreed, Martinez radioed.
He's gone, ma'am.
Watney's gone.
The 4 crewmates awaited their commander's response.
Copy, she finally replied.
On my way.
They lay in silence, strapped to their couches and ready for launch. Beck looked at Watney's empty couch and saw Vogel doing the same. Martinez ran a self-check on the nose cone OMS thrusters. They were no longer safe for use. He noted the malfunction in his log. The airlock cycled. After removing her suit, Lewis made her way to the flight cabin. She wordlessly strapped into her couch, her face a frozen mask. Only Martinez dared speak.
Still at pilot release, he said quietly. Ready for launch?
Lewis closed her eyes and nodded.
I'm sorry, Commander, Martinez said.
You need to verbally
launch, she said.
Yes, ma'am, he replied, activating the sequence.
The retaining clamps ejected from the launch gantry, falling to the ground. Seconds later, pre-ignition pyros fired, igniting the main engines, and the MAV lurched upward. The ship slowly gained speed. As it did, wind shear blew it laterally off course. Sensing the problem, the ascent software angled the ship into the wind to counteract it. As fuel was consumed, the ship got lighter and the acceleration more pronounced. Rising at this exponential rate, the craft quickly reached maximum acceleration, a limit defined not by the ship's power but by the delicate human bodies inside. As the ship soared, the open OMS ports took their toll. The crew rocked in their couches as the craft shook violently. Martinez and the ascent software kept it trim, though it was a constant battle. The turbulence tapered off and eventually fell to nothing as the atmosphere became thinner and thinner. Suddenly, all force stopped. The first stage had been completed. The crew experienced weightlessness for several seconds, then were pressed back into their couches as the next stage began. Outside, the now-empty first stage fell away, eventually to crash on some unknown area of the planet below. The second stage pushed the ship ever higher and into low orbit. Lasting less time than the massive first stage and thrusting much more smoothly, it seemed almost like an afterthought. Abruptly, the engine stopped, and an oppressive calm replaced the previous cacophony.
"Main engine shutdown," Martinez said. "Ascent time, 8 minutes, 14 seconds. On course for Hermes intercept."
Normally, an incident-free launch would be cause for celebration. This one earned only silence, broken by Johansson's gentle sobbing. 4 months later, Beck tried not to think about the painful reason he was doing zero-G plant growth experiments. He noted the size and shape of the fern leaves, took photos, and made notes. Having completed his science schedule for the day, he checked his watch. Perfect timing. The data dump would be completing soon. He floated past the reactor to the semicone A ladder. Traveling feet first along the ladder, he soon had to grip it in earnest as the centripetal force of the rotating ship took hold. By the time he reached semicone A, he was at 0.4G. No mere luxury, the centripetal gravity of Hermes kept them fit. Without it, they would have spent their first week on Mars barely able to walk. Zero-G exercise regimens could keep the heart and bones healthy, but none had been devised that would give them full function from Sol 1. Because the ship was already designed for it, they used the system on the return trip as well. Johansson sat at her station. Lewis sat in the adjacent seat while Vogel and Martinez hovered nearby. The data dump carried emails and videos from home. It was the high point of the day.
"Is it here yet?" Beck asked as he entered the bridge.
"Almost," Johansson said. 98%."
"You're looking cheerful, Martinez," Beck said.
"My son turned 3 yesterday," he beamed. "Should be some pics of the party. How about you?"
"Nothing special," Beck said. "Peer reviews of a paper I wrote a few years back."
"Complete," Johansson said. "All the personal emails are dispatched to your laptops. Also, there's a telemetry update for Vogel and a system update for me."
"Huh. There's a voice message addressed to the whole crew."
She looked over her shoulder to Lewis. Lewis shrugged.
"Play it."
Johansson opened the message, then sat back.
"Hermes, this is Mitch Henderson," the message began.
"Henderson," Martinez said, puzzled. "Talking directly to us without Capcom?"
Lewis held her hand up to signal for silence.
"I have some news," Mitch's voice continued. "There's no subtle way to put this. Mark Watney's still alive."
Johansson gasped.
"Whoa," Beck stammered.
Vogel stood with his mouth agape as a shocked expression swept across his face. Martinez looked to Lewis. She leaned forward and pinched her chin.
"I know that's a surprise," Mitch continued, "and I know you'll have a lot of questions. We're going to answer those questions, but for now I'll just give you the basics. He's alive and healthy. We found out 2 months ago and decided not to tell you. We even censored personal messages. I was strongly against all that. We're telling you now because we finally have communication with him and a viable rescue plan. It boils down to Ares IV picking him up with a modified MDV. We'll get you a full write-up of what happened, but it's definitely not your fault. Mark stresses that every time it comes up. It was just bad luck. Take some time to absorb this. Your science schedules are cleared for tomorrow. Send all the questions you want and we'll answer them. Henderson out."
The message's end brought stunned silence to the bridge.
He's alive," Martinez said, then smiled.
Vogel nodded excitedly.
"He lives."
Johansson stared at her screen in wide-eyed disbelief.
"Holy shit," Beck laughed. "Holy shit, Commander, he's alive."
"I left him behind," Lewis said quietly.
The celebrations ceased immediately as the crew saw their commander's expression.
"But," Beck began, "we all left together."
"You followed orders," Lewis interrupted. "I left him behind, in a barren, unreachable, God-forsaken wasteland."
Beck looked to Martinez pleadingly. Martinez opened his mouth, but could find no words to say. Lewis trudged off the bridge. Chapter 13. The employees of Deo Plastics worked double shifts to finish the HAB canvas for Ares 3. There was talk of triple shifts if NASA increased the order again. No one minded. The overtime pay was spectacular, and the funding was limitless. Woven carbon thread ran slowly through the press, which sandwiched it between polymer sheets. The completed material was folded four times and glued together. The resulting thick sheet was then coated with soft resin and taken to the hot room to set. Log entry, Sol 114. Now that NASA can talk to me, they won't shut the hell up. They want constant updates on every HAB system, and they've got a room full of people trying to micromanage my crops. It's awesome to have a bunch of dipshits on Earth telling me, a botanist, how to grow plants. I mostly ignore them. I don't want to come off as arrogant here, but I'm the best botanist on the planet. One big bonus, email. Just like the days back on Hermes, I get data dumps. Of course, they relay email from friends and family, but NASA also sends along choice messages from the public. I've gotten email from rock stars, athletes, actors and actresses, and even the president. One of them was from my alma mater, the University of Chicago. They say once you grow crops somewhere, you have officially colonized it. So technically, I colonized Mars. In your face, Neil Armstrong! But my favorite email was the one from my mother. It's exactly what you'd expect. Thank God you're alive, stay strong, don't die, your father says hello, etc. I read it 50 times in a row. Hey, don't get me wrong, I'm not a mama's boy or anything. I'm a full-grown man who only occasionally wears diapers. You have to in an EVA suit. It's totally manly and normal for me to cling to a letter from my mom. It's not like I'm some homesick kid at camp, right? Admittedly, I have to schlep to the rover 5 times a day to check email. They can get a message from Earth to Mars, but they can't get it another 10 meters to the HAB. But hey, I can't bitch. My odds of living through this are way higher now. Last I'd heard, they'd solved the weight problem on Ares 4's MDV. Once it lands here, they'll ditch the heat shield, all the life support stuff, and a bunch of empty fuel tanks. Then they can take the 7 of us, Ares 4's crew plus me, all the way to Schiaparelli. They're already working on my duties for the surface ops. How cool is that? In other news, I'm learning Morse code. Why? Because it's our backup communications system. NASA figured a decades-old probe isn't ideal as a sole means of communication. If Pathfinder craps out, I'll spell messages with rocks, which NASA will see with satellites. They can't reply, but at least we'd have one-way communication. Why Morse code? Because making dots and dashes with rocks is a lot easier than making letters. It's a shitty way to communicate. Hopefully it won't come up. All chemical reactions complete, the sheet was sterilized and moved to a clean room. There, a worker cut a strip off the edge, divided it into squares, and put each through a series of rigorous tests. Having passed inspection, the sheet was then cut to shape. The edges were folded over, sewn, and resealed with resin. A man with a clipboard made final inspections, independently verifying the measurements, then approved it for use. Log entry, Sol 115. The meddling botanists have grudgingly admitted I did a good job. They agree I'll have enough food to last until Sol 900. Bearing that in mind, NASA has fleshed out the mission details of the supply probe. At first, they were working on a desperate plan to get a probe here before Sol 400, but I bought another 500 souls of life with my potato farm, so they have more time to work on it. They'll launch next year during the Hohmann transfer window, and it'll take almost 9 months to get here. It should arrive around Sol 856. It'll have plenty of food, a spare oxygenator, water reclaimer, and comm system. 3 comm systems, actually. I guess they aren't taking any chances, what with my habit of being nearby when radios break. Got my first email from Hermes today. NASA's been limiting direct contact. I guess they're afraid I'll say something like, "You abandoned me on Mars, you assholes!" I know the crew was surprised to hear from the ghost of Mars missions past, but come on. I wish NASA was less of a nanny sometimes. Anyway, they finally let one email through from the commander. Watney, obviously we're very happy to hear you survived. As the person responsible for your situation, I wish there was more I could do to directly help, but it looks like NASA has a good rescue plan. I'm sure you'll continue to show your incredible resourcefulness and get through this. Looking forward to buying you a beer back on Earth. Lewis. My reply. Commander, pure bad luck is responsible for my situation, not you. You made the right call and saved everyone else. I know it must have been a tough decision, but any analysis of that day will show it was the right one. Get everyone else home, and I'll be happy. I will take you up on that beer, though. Watney. The employees carefully folded the sheet and placed it in an argon-filled, airtight shipping container. The man with the clipboard placed a sticker on the package. Project Ares 3, Hab Canvas, Sheet AL-102. The package was placed on a charter plane and flown to Edwards Air Force Base in California. It flew abnormally high at great cost of fuel to ensure a smoother flight. Upon arrival, the package was carefully transported by special convoy to Pasadena. Once there, it was moved to the JPL spacecraft assembly facility. Over the next 5 weeks, engineers in white bodysuits assembled Pre-Supply 309. It contained AL-102, as well as 12 other HAB Canvas packages. Log entry, Sol 116.
It's almost time for the second harvest.
Yep. I wish I had a straw hat and some suspenders. My reseed of the potatoes went well. I'm beginning to see that crops on Mars are extremely prolific, thanks to the billions of dollars worth of life support equipment around me. I now have 400 healthy potato plants, each one making lots of calorie-filled taters for my dining enjoyment. In just 10 days, they'll be ripe. And this time I'm not replanting them as seed. This is my food supply, all natural, organic, Martian-grown potatoes. Don't hear that every day, do you? You may be wondering how I'll store them. I can't just pile them up. Most of them would go bad before I got around to eating them, so instead, I'll do something that wouldn't work at all on Earth. Throw them outside. Most of the water will be sucked out by the near vacuum. What's left will freeze solid. Any bacteria planning to rot my taters will die screaming. In other news, I got an email from Venkat Kapoor.
Mark, some answers to your earlier questions. No, we will not tell our botany team to go fuck themselves. I understand you've been on your own for a long time, but we're in the loop now, and it's best if you listen to what we have to say. The Cubs finished the season at the bottom of the NL Central. The data transfer rate just isn't good enough for the size of music files, even in compressed formats, so your request for Anything, Oh God, Anything But Disco is denied. Enjoy your boogie fever. Also, an uncomfortable side note. NASA is putting together a committee. They want to see if there were any avoidable mistakes that led you to being stranded. Just a heads up. They may have questions for you later on. Keep us posted on your activities. Kapoor.
My reply. Venkat, tell the investigation committee they'll have to do their witch hunt without me. And when they inevitably blame Commander Lewis, be advised I'll publicly refute it. I'm sure the rest of the crew will do the same. Also, please tell them that each and every one of their mothers is a prostitute. Watney. P.S. Their sisters, too. The pre-supply probes for Ares 3 launched on 14 consecutive days during the Hohmann transfer window. Pre-supply 309 was launched third. The 251-day trip to Mars was uneventful, needing only 2 minor course adjustments. After several aerobraking maneuvers to slow down, it made its final descent toward Acidalia Planitia. First, it endured re-entry via a heat shield. Later, it released a parachute and detached the now expended shield. Once its onboard radar detected it was 30 meters from the ground, it cut loose the parachute and inflated balloons all around its hull. It fell unceremoniously to the surface, bouncing and rolling until it finally came to rest. Deflating its balloons, the onboard computer reported the successful landing back to Earth. Then it waited 23 months. Log entry, Sol 117. The water reclaimer is acting up. 6 people will go through 18 liters of water per day, so it's made to process 20, but lately it hasn't been keeping up. It's doing 10, tops. Do I generate 10 liters of water per day? No, I'm not the urinating champion of all time. It's the crops. The humidity inside the hab is a lot higher than it was designed for, so the water reclaimer is constantly filtering it out of the air. I'm not worried about it. If need be, I can piss directly onto the plants. The plants will take their share of water, and the rest will condense on the walls. I could make something to collect the condensation, I'm sure. Thing is, the water can't go anywhere. It's a closed system. Okay, technically I'm lying. The plants aren't entirely water neutral. They strip the hydrogen from some of it, releasing the oxygen, and use it to make the complex hydrocarbons that are the plant itself. But it's a very small loss. And I made like 600 liters of water from MDV fuel. I could take baths and still have plenty left over. NASA, however, is absolutely shitting itself. They see the water reclaimer as a critical survival element. There's no backup, and they think I'll die instantly without it. To them, equipment failure is terrifying. To me, it's Tuesday. So instead of preparing for my harvest, I have to make extra trips to and from the rover to answer their questions. Each new message instructs me to try some new solution and report the results back. So far as we've worked out, it's not the electronics, refrigeration system, instrumentation, or temperature. I'm sure it'll turn out to be a little hole somewhere. Then NASA will have 4 hours of meetings before telling me to cover it with duct tape. Lewis and Beck opened pre-supply 309. Working as best they could in their bulky EVA suits, they removed the various portions of hab canvas and laid them on the ground. 3 entire pre-supply probes were dedicated to the hab. Following a procedure they had practiced hundreds of times, they efficiently assembled the pieces. Special seal strips between the patches ensured airtight mating. After erecting the main structure of the hab, they assembled the 3 airlocks. Sheet AL-102 had a hole perfectly sized for airlock 1. Beck stretched the sheet tight to the seal strips on the airlock's exterior. Once all airlocks were in place, Lewis flooded the hab with air, and AL-102 felt pressure for the first time. Lewis and Beck waited an hour. No pressure was lost. The setup had been perfect. Log entry, Sol 118. My conversation with NASA about the water reclaimer was boring and riddled with technical details, so I'll paraphrase it for you. Me. This is obviously a clog. How about I take it apart and check the internal tubing? NASA. After 5 hours of deliberation. No, you'll fuck it up and die. So I took it apart. Yeah, I know NASA has a lot of ultra-smart people, and I should really do what they say. And I'm being too adversarial, considering they spend all day working on how to save my life. I just get sick of being told how to wipe my ass. Independence was one of the qualities they looked for when choosing Ares astronauts. It's a 13-month mission. Most of it spent many light minutes away from Earth. They wanted people who would act on their own initiative. If Commander Lewis were here, I'd do whatever she said, no problem. But a committee of faceless bureaucrats back on Earth? Sorry. I'm just having a tough time with it. I was really careful. I labeled every piece as I dismantled it and laid everything out on a table. I had the schematics in the computer, so nothing was a surprise. And just as I'd suspected, there was a clogged tube. The water reclaimer was designed to purify urine and strain humidity out of the air. You exhale almost as much water as you piss. I've mixed my water with soil, making it mineral water. The minerals built up in the water reclaimer. I cleaned out the tubing and put it all back together. It completely solved the problem. I'll have to do it again someday, but not for 100 sols or so. No big deal. I told NASA what I did. Our, paraphrased, conversation was me. I took it apart, found the problem, and fixed it. NASA.
Dick.
AL-102 shuddered in the brutal storm. With standing forces far greater than it was designed for, it rippled violently against the airlock seal strip. Other sections of canvas undulated along their seal strips together, acting as a single sheet, but AL-102 had no such luxury. The airlock barely moved, leaving AL-102 to take the full force of the tempest. The layers of plastic, constantly bending, heated the resin from pure friction. The new, more yielding environment allowed the carbon fibers to separate. AL-102 stretched. Not much, only 4 millimeters. But the carbon fibers, usually 500 microns apart, now had a gap 8 times that width in their midst. After the storm abated, the lone remaining astronaut performed a full inspection of the HAB. But he didn't notice anything amiss. The weak part of canvas was concealed by a seal strip. Designed for a mission of 31 souls, AL-102 continued well past its planned expiration. Soul after soul went by, with the lone astronaut traveling in and out of the HAB almost daily. Airlock 1 was closest to the rover charging station, so the astronaut preferred it to the other two. When pressurized, the airlock expanded slightly. When depressurized, it shrunk. Every time the astronaut used the airlock, the strain on AL-102 relaxed, then tightened anew. Pulling, stressing, weakening, stretching. Log entry, Sol 119. I woke up last night to the HAB shaking. The medium-grade sandstorm ended as suddenly as it began. It was only a Category 3 storm with 50 kilometers per hour winds. Nothing to worry about. Still, it's a bit disconcerting to hear howling winds when you're used to utter silence. I'm worried about Pathfinder. If the sandstorm damaged it, I'll have lost my connection to NASA. Logically, I shouldn't worry. The thing's been on the surface for decades. A little gale won't do any harm. When I head outside, I'll confirm Pathfinder's still functional before moving on to the sweaty, annoying work of the day. Yes, with each sandstorm comes the inevitable cleaning of the solar cells, a time-honored tradition among hardy Martians such as myself. It reminds me of growing up in Chicago and having to shovel snow. I'll give my dad credit. He never claimed it was to build character or teach me the value of hard work. "Snowblowers are expensive," he used to say. "You're free." Once I tried to appeal to my mom. "Don't be such a wuss," she suggested. In other news, it's 7 souls till the harvest, and I still haven't prepared. For starters, I need to make a hoe. Also, I need to make an outdoor shed for the potatoes. I can't just pile them up outside. The next major storm would cause the great Martian potato migration. Anyway, all that will have to wait. I've got a full day today. After cleaning the solar cells, I have to check the whole solar array to make sure the storm didn't hurt it. Then I'll need to do the same for the rover. I better get started. Airlock 1 slowly depressurized to 0.006 atmospheres. Watney, wearing an EVA suit, stood inside it waiting for the cycle to complete. He had done it literally hundreds of times. Any apprehension he may have had on Sol 1 was long gone. Now it was merely a boring chore before exiting to the surface. As the depressurization continued, the HAB's atmosphere compressed the airlock, and AL-102 stretched for the last time. On Sol 119, the HAB breached. The initial tear was less than 1 millimeter. The perpendicular carbon fibers should have prevented the rip from growing, but countless abuses had stretched the vertical fibers apart and weakened the horizontal ones beyond use. The full force of the HAB's atmosphere rushed through the breach. Within a tenth of a second, the rip was a meter long, running parallel to the seal strip. It propagated all the way around until it met its starting point. The airlock was no longer attached to the HAB. The unopposed pressure launched the airlock like a cannonball as the HAB's atmosphere explosively escaped through the breach. Inside, the surprised Watney slammed against the airlock's back door with the force of the expulsion. The airlock flew 40 meters before hitting the ground. Watney, barely recovered from the earlier shock, now endured another as he hit the front door face first. His faceplate took the brunt of the blow, the safety glass shattering into hundreds of small cubes.
His head slammed against the inside of the helmet, knocking him senseless. The airlock tumbled across the surface for a further 15 meters. The heavy padding of Watney's suit saved him from many broken bones. He tried to make sense of the situation, but he was barely conscious. Finally done tumbling, the airlock rested on its side amid a cloud of dust. Watney, on his back, stared blankly upward through the hole in his shattered faceplate. A gash in his forehead trickled blood down his face. Regaining some of his wits, he got his bearings. Turning his head to the side, he looked through the back door's window. The collapsed hab rippled in the distance, a junkyard of debris strewn across the landscape in front of it. Then a hissing sound reached his ears. Listening carefully, he realized it was not coming from his suit. Somewhere in the phone booth-sized airlock, a small breach was letting air escape. He listened intently to the hiss, then he touched his broken faceplate. Then he looked out the window again.
"You fucking kidding me?" he said.
Chapter 14. Audio log transcript. Sol 119.
"You know what? Fuck this. Fuck this airlock, fuck that hab, and fuck this whole planet. Seriously, this is it. I've had it. I've got a few minutes before I run out of air, and I'll be damned if I spend them playing Mars's little game. I'm so goddamn sick of it I could puke. All I have to do is sit here. The air will leak out and I'll die. I'll be done. No more getting my hopes up, no more self-delusion, and no more problem-solving. I've fucking had it."
Audio log transcript. Sol 119. 2.
Sigh. "Okay. I've had my tantrum, and now I have to figure out how to stay alive. Again. Okay, let's see what I can do here. I'm in the airlock. I can see the hab out the window. It's a good 50 meters away. Normally, the airlock is attached to the hab, so that's a problem. The airlock's on its side, and I can hear a steady hiss, so either it's leaking or there are snakes in here. Either way, I'm in trouble. Also, during the whatever the fuck happened, I got bounced around like a pinball and smashed my faceplate. Air is notoriously uncooperative when it comes to giant gaping holes in your EVA suit. Looks like the hab is completely deflated and collapsed, so even if I had a functional EVA suit to leave the airlock with, I wouldn't have anywhere to go. So that sucks. I gotta think for a minute. And I have to get out of this EVA suit. It's bulky, and the airlock is cramped. Besides, it's not like it's doing me any good."
Audio log transcript. Sol 119. 3. "Things aren't as bad as they seem. I'm still fucked, mind you, just not as deeply. Not sure what happened to the hab, but the rover's probably fine. It's not ideal, but at least it's not a leaky phone booth. I have a patch kit on my EVA suit, of course, the same kind that saved my life back on Sol 6. But don't get excited. It won't do the suit any good. The patch kit is a cone-shaped valve with super sticky resin on the wide end. It's just too small to deal with a hole larger than 8 centimeters. And really, if you have a 9-centimeter hole, you're going to be dead way before you could whip out the kit. Still, it's an asset, and maybe I can use it to stop the airlock leak. And that's my top priority right now. It's a small leak. With the faceplate gone, the EVA suit is effectively managing the whole airlock. It's been adding air to make up for the missing pressure, but it'll run out eventually. I need to find the leak. I think it's near my feet, judging by the sound. Now that I'm out of the suit, I can turn around and get a look. I don't see anything. I can hear it, but it's down here somewhere, but I don't know where. I can only think of one way to find it. Start a fire. Yeah, I know. A lot of my ideas involve setting something on fire. And yes, deliberately starting a fire in a tiny enclosed space is usually a terrible idea. But I need the smoke, just a little wisp of it. As usual, I'm working with stuff that was deliberately designed not to burn. But no amount of careful design by NASA can get around a determined arsonist with a tank of pure oxygen. Unfortunately, the EVA suit is made entirely of non-flammable materials. So is the airlock. My clothes are fireproof as well, even the thread.
I was originally planning to check the solar array, doing repairs as needed after last night's storm, so I have my toolbox with me. But looking through it, I see it's all metal or non-flammable plastic. I just realized I do have something flammable. My own hair. It'll have to do. There's a sharp knife in the toolkit. I'll shave some arm hairs off into a little pile. Next step, oxygen. I don't have anything so refined as pure oxygen flow. All I can do is muck with the EVA suit controls to increase oxygen percentage in the whole airlock. I figure bumping it to 40% will do. All I need now is a spark. The EVA suit has electronics, but it runs on very low voltage. I don't think I could get an arc with it. Besides, I don't want to mess with the suit. I need it working to get from the airlock to the rover. The airlock itself has electronics, but it ran on HAB power. I guess NASA never considered what would happen if it was launched 50 meters. Lazy bums. Plastic might not burn, but anyone who's played with a balloon knows it's great at building up static charge. Once I do that, I should be able to make a spark just by touching a metal tool. Fun fact, this is exactly how the Apollo 1 crew died. Wish me luck. Audio log transcript. Sol 119. 4. I'm in a box full of burning hair smell. It's not a good smell. On my first try, the fire lit, but the smoke just drifted randomly around. My own breathing was screwing it up, so I held my breath and tried again. My second try, the EVA suit threw everything off. There's a gentle flow of air coming out of the faceplate as the suit constantly replaces the missing air, so I shut the suit down, held my breath, and tried again. I had to be quick. The pressure was dropping. My third try, the quick arm movements I used to set the fire messed everything up. Just moving around makes enough turbulence to send the smoke everywhere. The fourth time, I kept the suit turned off, held my breath, and when the time came to light the fire, I did it very slowly. Then I watched as the little wisp of smoke drifted toward the floor of the airlock, disappearing through a hairline fracture. "I have you now, little leak." I gasped for air and turned the EVA suit back on. The pressure had dropped to 0.9 atmospheres during my little experiment, but there was plenty of oxygen in the air for me and my hair fire to breathe. The suit quickly got things back to normal. Looking at the fracture, I see that it's pretty tiny. It would be a cinch to seal it with the suit's patch kit, but now that I think about it, that's a bad idea. I'll need to do some kind of repair to the faceplate. I don't know how just yet, but the patch kit and its pressure-resistant resin are probably really important, and I can't do it bit by bit either. Once I break the seal on the patch kit, the binary components of the resin mix, and I have 60 seconds before it hardens. I can't just take a little to fix the airlock. Given time, I might be able to come up with a plan for the faceplate. Then I could take a few seconds during that plan to scrape resin over the airlock fracture. But I don't have time. I'm down to 40% of my N2 tank. I need to seal that fracture now, and I need to do it without using the patch kit. First idea. Little Dutch boy. I'm licking my palm and placing it over the crack. Okay, I can't quite make a perfect seal, so there's airflow. Getting colder now. Getting pretty uncomfortable. Okay, fuck this. On to idea number two. Tape. I have duct tape in my toolbox. Let's slap some on and see if it slows the flow. I wonder how long it will last before the pressure rips it. Putting it on now. There we go. Still holding. Let me check the suit. Readouts say the pressure's stable. Looks like the duct tape made a good seal. Let's see if it holds. Audio log transcript. Sol 119. 5. It's been 15 minutes and the tape is still holding. Looks like that problem is solved. Sort of anticlimactic, really. I was already working out how to cover the breach with ice. I have 2 liters of water in the EVA suit's hamster feeder. I could have shut off the suit's heating systems and let the airlock cool to freezing. Then I'd... well, whatever. Could have done it with ice, I'm just saying. All right, on to my next problem. How do I fix the EVA suit? Duct tape might seal a hairline crack, but it can't hold an atmosphere of pressure against the sides of my broken faceplate. The patch kit is too small, but still useful. I can spread the resin around the edge of where the faceplate was, then stick something on to cover the hole.
Problem is, what do I use to cover the hole? Something that can stand up to a lot of pressure. Looking around, the only thing I see that can hold an atmosphere is the EVA suit itself. There's plenty of material to work with, and I can even cut it. Remember when I was cutting hab canvas into strips? Those same shears are right here in my toolkit. Cutting a chunk out of my EVA suit leaves it with another hole, but a hole I can control the shape and location of. Yeah, I think I see a solution here. I'm going to cut off my arm. Well, no, not my arm. The EVA suit's arm. I'll cut right below the left elbow. Then I can cut along its length, turning it into a rectangle. It'll be big enough to seal the faceplate, and it'll be held in place by the resin. Material designed to withstand atmospheric pressure? Check. Resin designed to seal a breach against that pressure? Check. And what about the gaping hole on the stumpy arm? Unlike my faceplate, the suit's material is flexible. I'll press it together and seal it with resin. I'll have to press my left arm against my side while I'm in the suit, but there'll be room. I'll be spreading the resin pretty thin, but it's literally the strongest adhesive known to man, and it doesn't have to be a perfect seal. It just has to last long enough for me to get to safety. And where will that safety be? Not a damn clue. Anyway, one problem at a time. Right now, I'm fixing the EVA suit. Audio log transcript. Sol 119. 6. Cutting the arm off the suit was easy, so was cutting along its length to make a rectangle. Those shears are strong as hell. Cleaning the glass off the faceplate took longer than I'd expected. It's unlikely it would puncture EVA suit material, but I'm not taking any chances. Besides, I don't want glass in my face when I'm wearing it. Then came the tricky part. Once I broke the seal on the patch kit, I had 60 seconds before the resin set. I scooped it off the patch kit with my fingers and quickly spread it around the rim of the faceplate. Then I took what was left and sealed the armhole. I pressed the rectangle of suit material onto the helmets with both hands while using my knee to keep pressure on the arm's seam. I held on until I'd counted 120 seconds, just to be sure. It seemed to work well. The seal looked strong, and the resin was rock hard. I did, however, glue my hand to the helmet. Stop laughing. In retrospect, using my fingers to spread the resin wasn't the best plan. Fortunately, my left hand was still free. After some grunting and a lot of profanities, I was able to reach the toolbox. Once I got a screwdriver, I chiseled myself free, feeling really stupid the whole time. It was a delicate process because I didn't want to flay the skin off my fingers. I had to get the screwdriver between the helmet and the resin. I freed my hand and didn't draw blood, so I call that a win. Though I'll have hardened resin on my fingers for days, just like a kid who played with crazy glue. Using the arm computer, I had the suit overpressurized to 1.2 atmospheres. The faceplate patch bowed outward, but otherwise held firm. The arm filled in, threatening to tear the new seam, but stayed in one piece. Then I watched the readouts to see how airtight things were. Answer: not very. It absolutely pissed the air out. In 60 seconds, it leaked so much it pressurized the whole airlock to 1.2 atmospheres. The suit is designed for 8 hours of use. That works out to 250 milliliters of liquid oxygen. Just to be safe, the suit has a full liter of O2 capacity, but that's only half the story. The rest of the air is nitrogen. It's just there to add pressure. When the suit leaks, that's what it backfills with. The suit has 2 liters of liquid N2 storage. Let's call the volume of the airlock 2 cubic meters. The inflated EVA suit probably takes up half of it, so it took 5 minutes to add 0.2 atmospheres to 1 cubic meter. That's 285 grams of air. Trust me on the math. The air in the tanks is around 1 gram per cubic centimeter, meaning I just lost 285 milliliters. The 3 tanks combined had 3,000 milliliters to start with. A lot of that was used to maintain pressure while the airlock was leaking. Also, my breathing turned some oxygen into carbon dioxide, which was captured by the suit's CO2 filters. Checking the readouts, I see that I have 410 milliliters of oxygen, 738 milliliters of nitrogen. Together, they make almost 1,150 milliliters to work with. That, divided by 285 milliliters lost per minute. Once I'm out of the airlock, this EVA suit will only last 4 minutes. Fuck.
Audio log transcript, Sol 119. 7. Okay, I've been thinking some more. What good is going to the rover? I'd just be trapped there instead. The extra room would be nice, but I'd still die eventually. No water reclaimer, no oxygenator, no food. Take your pick. All of those problems are fatal. I need to fix the hab. I know what to do. We practiced it in training, but it'll take a long time. I'll have to scrounge around in the now-collapsed canvas to get the spare material for patching. Then I have to find the breech and seal strip a patch in place. But it'll take hours to repair, and my EVA suit is useless. I'll need another suit. Martinez is used to be in the rover. I hauled it all the way to the Pathfinder site and back just in case I needed a spare, but when I returned, I put it back in the hab. Damn it. All right, so I'll need to get another suit before going to the rover. Which one? Johansson's is too small for me. Tiny little gal, our Johansson. Lewis's is full of water. Actually, by now it's full of slowly sublimating ice. The mangled, glued-together suit I have with me is my original one. That leaves just Martinez, Vogel, and Bex. I left Martinez's near my bunk in case I needed a suit in a hurry. Of course, after that sudden decompression, it could be anywhere. Still, it's a place to start. Next problem. I'm like 50 meters from the hab. Running in 0.4G while wearing a bulky EVA suit isn't easy. At best, I can trundle 2 meters per second. That's a precious 25 seconds, almost an eighth of my 4 minutes. I've got to bring that down. But how? Audio log transcript. Sol 119. 8. I'll roll the damn airlock. It's basically a phone booth on its side. I did some experiments. I figured if I want it to roll, I'll need to hit the wall as hard as possible, and I have to be in the air at the time. I can't press against some other part of the airlock. The forces would cancel each other out, and it wouldn't move at all. First, I tried launching myself off one wall and slamming into the other. The airlock slid a little, but that's it. Next, I tried doing a super push-up to get airborne. 0.4G. Yay! Then kicking the wall with both feet. Again, it just slid. The third time, I got it right. The trick was to plant both my feet on the ground near the wall, then launch myself to the top of the opposite wall and hit with my back. When I tried that just now, it gave me enough force and leverage to tip the airlock and roll it one face toward the hab. The airlock is a meter wide, so... sigh. I have to do it like 50 more times. I'm gonna have a hell of a backache after this. Audio log transcript. Sol 120. I have a hell of a backache. The subtle and refined hurl-my-body-at-the-wall technique had some flaws. It worked only one out of every 10 tries, and it hurt a lot. I had to take breaks, stretch out, and generally convince myself to body-slam the wall again and again. It took all damn night, but I made it. I'm 10 meters from the hab now. I can't get any closer, because the debris from the decompression is all over the place. This isn't an all-terrain airlock. I can't roll over that shit. It was morning when the hab popped. Now it's morning again. I've been in this damn box for an entire day, but I'm leaving soon. I'm in the EVA suit now and ready to roll. All right. Okay. Once more through the plan. Use the manual valves to equalize the airlock. Get out and hurry to the hab. Wander around under the collapsed canvas. Find Martinez's suit, or Vogel's if I run into it first. Get to the rover. Then I'm safe. If I run out of time before finding a suit, I'll just run to the rover. I'll be in trouble, but I'll have time to think and materials to work with. Deep breath. Here we go. Log entry. Sol 120. I'm alive and I'm in the rover. Things didn't go exactly as planned, but I'm not dead, so it's a win. Equalizing the airlock went fine. I was out on the surface within 30 seconds. Skipping toward the hab, the fastest way to move in this gravity, I passed through the field of debris. The rupture had really sent things flying, myself included. It was hard to see. My faceplate was covered by the makeshift patch. Fortunately, my arm had a camera.
NASA discovered that turning your whole EVA-suited body to look at something was a strenuous waste of time, so they mounted a small camera on the right arm. The feed is projected on the inner faceplate. This allows us to look at things just by pointing at them. The faceplate patch wasn't exactly smooth or reflective, so I had to look at a rippled, messed-up version of the camera feed. Still, it was enough to see what was going on. I beelined for where the airlock used to be. I knew there had to be a pretty big hole there, so I'd be able to get in. I found it easily. And boy, is it a nasty rip. It's going to be a pain in the ass to fix it. That's when the flaws in my plan started to reveal themselves. I only had one arm to work with. My left arm was pinned against my body, while the stumpy arm of the suit bounced freely, so as I moved around under the canvas, I had to use my one good arm to hold the canvas up. It slowed me down. From what I could see, the interior of the HAB is chaos. Everything's moved. Entire tables and bunks are meters away from where they started. Lighter objects are wildly jumbled, many of them out on the surface. Everything's covered in soil and mangled potato plants. Trudging onward, I got to where I'd left Martinez's suit. To my shock, it was still there. Yay, I naively thought, problem solved. Unfortunately, the suit was pinned under a table, which was held down by the collapsed canvas. If I'd had both arms, I could have pulled it free, but with only one, I just couldn't do it. Running low on time, I detached the helmet. Setting it aside, I reached past the table to get Martinez's patch kit. I found it with the help of the arm camera. I dropped it in the helmet and hauled ass out of there. I barely made it to the rover in time. My ears were popping from pressure loss just as the rover's airlock filled with wonderful one-atmosphere air. Crawling in, I collapsed and panted for a moment. So I'm back in the rover, just like I was on the Great Pathfinder Recovery Expedition. Ugh, at least this time it smells a little better. NASA's probably pretty worried about me by now. They probably saw the airlock move back to the HAB, so they know I'm alive, but they'll want status. And as it happens, it's the rover that communicates with Pathfinder. I tried to send a message, but Pathfinder isn't responding. That's not a big surprise. It's powered directly from the HAB, and the HAB is offline. During my brief, panicked scramble outside, I saw that Pathfinder was right where I left it, and the debris didn't reach that far out. It should be fine once I get it some power. As for my current situation, the big gain is the helmet. They're interchangeable, so I can replace my broken-ass one with Martinez's. The stumpy arm is still an issue, but the faceplate was the main source of leaks. And with the fresh patch kit, I can seal the arm with more resin. But that can wait. I've been awake for over 24 hours. I'm not in any immediate danger, so I'm going to sleep. Log entry. Sol 121. Got a good night's sleep and made real progress today. First thing I did was reseal the arm. Last time I had to spread the resin pretty thin. I'd used most of it for the faceplate patch, but this time I had a whole patch kit just for the arm. I got a perfect seal. I still only had a one-armed suit, but at least it didn't leak. I'd lost most of my air yesterday, but I had a half hour of oxygen left. Like I said earlier, a human body doesn't need much oxygen. Maintaining pressure was the problem. With that much time, I was able to take advantage of the rover's EVA tank refill, something I couldn't do with the leaky suit. The tank refill is an emergency measure. The expected use of the rover is to start with full EVA suits and come back with air to spare. It wasn't designed for long trips or even overnighters, but just in case of emergency, it has refill hoses mounted on the exterior. Inside space was limited already, and NASA concluded that most air-related emergencies would be outdoors. But refilling is slow, slower than my suit was leaking, so it wasn't any use to me until I swapped helmets. Now, with a solid suit capable of holding pressure, refilling the tanks was a breeze. After refilling and making sure the suit was still not leaking, I had a few immediate tasks to take care of. Much as I trust my handiwork, I wanted a two-armed suit. I ventured back into the HAB. This time, not being rushed, I was able to use a pole to leverage the table off Martinez's suit. Pulling it loose, I dragged it back to the rover. After a thorough diagnostic, to be sure, I finally had a fully functional EVA suit. It took me two trips to get it, but I got it. Tomorrow, I'll fix the HAB. Log entry.
Soul 122. The first thing I did today was line up rocks near the rover to spell A-O-K. That should make NASA happy. I went into the hab again to assess damage. My priority will be to get the structure intact and holding pressure. From there, I can work on fixing stuff that broke. The hab is normally a dome, with flexible support poles maintaining the arch and rigid folding